Republicans search for a frontrunner, Democrats smooth over their differences, and the battle for control of Congress heats up. We're talking 2016 on this special edition of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. With a year to go before the election, the Republicans have yet to rally around a particular candidate.
We thought that he'd be killed by some of the crazy statements he'd made. We thought that he'd be killed by the fact that he has no experience in public office. We thought that one of these other candidates would catch on against him. None of that has happened, and Republicans are beginning to say, nobody can beat this guy.
While there seems to be some coalescing on the Democratic side.
Her negative ratings are a little bit artificially inflated by the unrelentingly negative coverage. I think when we get to a point where we may not know who the nominee is on the Republican side, but we have a clear sense of the front runner, and it becomes more of a Democratic versus Republican nationalized race, you will see her popular among Democrats and competitive.
But no matter what happens, we know that the results in Iowa will determine both parties' nominees. Or not.
One of the criticisms made of the process is that it can pull nominees either too far to the right or too far to the left and make them unelectable in November.
That's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us and welcome to The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. 2 years ago, with no money but lots of dreams, I started this program with the belief that politics could be entertaining and informative at the same time. And that's what we've done week after week. This week, we're celebrating our 100th episode of The Political Junkie.
I never thought I'd live to be 100. I never thought I'd get to do the things that all those others do.
For months, we've all been hearing plenty about the 2016 campaign. Who's leading in the polls this week? Who's drawing the biggest crowds? What incendiary comment did Donald Trump just make? And for how long can we speculate about whether Joe Biden would challenge Hillary Clinton? Of course, nobody has cast a vote in any state yet, and we still have a year to go until the election is finally decided. So, in this special edition of The Political Junkie, we're going to take a broad look at where the 2016 campaign stands right now. And there's no better way to start this special program other than with our two favorite political analysts, Anna Greenberg and Vin Weber. Vin Weber is a partner at the Mercury lobbying firm, a former member of Congress from Minnesota, and a leading Republican strategist. Anna Greenberg is a senior vice president with the research firm Greenberg, Quinlan and Rosner, and a leading Democratic pollster. Anna and Vin, I'm thrilled to have you for this special 100th episode.
It's an honor.
It's a lot of fun to be with you,
as always. It's an honor.
It's an honor. It's an honor, but it's more fun.
It's an honor and a pleasure.
Okay, let's start, Vin, because I think that more of the headlines seem to be on the Republican side. Where does the Republican race stand at this point?
Well, this is, we're about 3.5 months into Donald Trump consistently leading in all the polls. And 3.5 months or so ago, no one thought that he was going to A, run, B, last more than about 30 days, and that's all been proven wrong. Now the consensus has almost shifted the opposite direction from he can't possibly win to nobody can possibly beat him. And that may be a little premature for me to say, but I'm hearing it more and more and more from people. I say, well, we thought that he'd be killed by some of the crazy statements he'd made. We thought that he'd be killed by the fact that he has no experience in public office. We thought that one of these other candidates would catch on against him. None of that has happened. And Republicans are beginning to say, you know, nobody can beat this guy. I don't think that's true either, but I think that's where the consensus is moving toward, at least in the short term.
And if you look at his positions on so many issues, as well as the history of his positions on so many issues, they're not exactly Republican dogma.
No, he's just objectively speaking, and I don't want to be disrespectful, or he may attack me, who knows, but he's not really a Republican or a Democrat or a liberal or a conservative. He's Donald Trump, and he's decided to, after a little bit of controversy, he decided to run as the Republican and pledge himself to the Republican process. But it doesn't change who he really is. He's an independent force of nature in the political process who has figured out how to dominate the headlines every day. He's figured out how to communicate in this environment, maybe because of his entertainment background as opposed to his real estate background, better than anybody else in the field.
And second in the polls, I mean, again, we're talking about October, November of 2015, but Ben Carson, another outsider, doing surprisingly well.
Surprisingly well, and surprisingly durable, just like Donald Trump. I mean, we saw in the last cycle, people like Michelle Bachmann and Herman Cain and even Newt Gingrich would sort of jump to the top of the polls for a very short period of time, and then they'd fall off.
Rick Perry also, right?
Rick Perry, exactly. But Donald Trump and Ben Carson have been fairly durable in their support as the number one and number two candidates, and Carson's actually narrowed the gap with Trump, according to most polls recently. And it's kind of odd, because other than the fact people say it's because he's just an outsider like Trump, but other than that fact, they are such totally different personalities.
Completely
it's hard to explain why they would be the two front-running candidates.
And I think the biggest surprise, I'll get to, what's your name again, Anna? I'll get to you in 1 second. But let me just, one big surprise for the Republicans is that in addition to Trump and Carson, the conventional wisdom was that, okay, we have another Bush. He has all the money. He'll probably get most of the endorsements. He has a great Rolodex. What's happened to Jeb Bush?
Well, I think that the environment was very different than he expected. I don't rule Jeb Bush out by any means. I'm very supportive of him myself. But, you know, I'm objective about it. I know what the polls say, and I know that Trump has a lot of money, and Carson's raising a lot of money, too. But Bush still has a durable presence in this race. And I have to believe that if, I don't like the term even, but if some so-called establishment figure is going to emerge as a challenger to these outsiders, Bush is still by far the best by virtue of his record, best by virtue of his organization, best by virtue of his ability to raise money, and best by virtue of having a fairly coherent and defined Republican message.
And on the Democratic side, I mean, we see the polls that show Hillary Clinton with questions about trustworthiness and honesty, and yet, if you look at where she stands in every survey, I mean, maybe not so much in the early states, but nationally, a huge double-digit lead over any Democratic challenger.
Right. She had the unfortunate experience of unrelentingly negative coverage, justified or not, starting with the Clinton Foundation donations, going through email. And that has been the only thing that the media has covered, even though she's put out, you know, very significant policy proposals on CEO compensation, et cetera. And so I think people forgot that she's actually a pretty good candidate and that those skills have been honed as Secretary of State. And when she got on the stage in the debate and was
the first debate
and sort of towered over everybody else, they were reminded, oh, she's smart. She knows what she's talking about. She actually has some charisma. And I think that, you know, her negative ratings are a little bit artificially inflated by the unrelentingly negative coverage and the fact that most of the coverage is on the Republican primary. I think when we get to a point where we may not know who the nominee is on the Republican side, but we have a clear sense of the front runner and it becomes more of a Democratic versus Republican nationalized race, you will see her, you know, I think popular among Democrats and competitive.
For all the, I mean, in fairness, there is an FBI investigation into the emails or at least what happened there and whether there's any security risk or things like that. I mean, it's not just the media and the Republicans who were jumping on her, correct?
Yes, there's an investigation. What I'm suggesting is that she has a fully rounded campaign where she's talking about a lot of things that never get covered. Now, I understand why the media covers the email scandal because it's, you know, newsworthy, sells newspapers. It's scandalous, but she can't break out of it. And I think that first debate helped her break out of it for the first time, especially for Democratic primary voters, particularly when Bernie Sanders said, I think the email thing is ridiculous and we should stop focusing on it.
Her damn emails, yeah.
Right.
I mean, if there was any debate in the Democratic Party on whether this was an issue, it seemed like Sanders' comment and the response to it seemed to make it go away, at least among the Democrats. What do you make of the Joe Biden decision? I mean, for the longest time, they were saying, if only Joe Biden would run, if only would, and we always said, how could he run? He has no money, he has no organization, he has no time left. Hillary Clinton has raised a ton of money. Bernie Sanders has raised a ton of money. I mean, it's been a while since Biden dropped out, but surprised, not surprised?
I'm not surprised he didn't run. I think that if he really had the fire in his belly, even post Beau Biden passing away, he would have been doing other things to lay the groundwork. I truly believe Hillary Clinton did not know if she was going to run for president a year ago, and that if he had sent the smoke signals that he was going to run and start locking up institutional support and started raising some money, he would have given her a real run for the money in the primary. But he's never done anything besides allow some rumors to swirl. And it's not necessarily true in Republican primaries as much as Democratic primaries, but on the ground, infrastructure matters a lot. And he would have been so far behind on that. So I'm not surprised he's not running, because I think he would have done stuff earlier. And I think if he had run, it would have been a disaster.
You say it's not you're not surprised by Biden's decision. Has anything on the Democratic side surprised you, particularly surprised you so far?
Well, I think Bernie Sanders' strength is a little surprising, but in some ways, when you think about it harder, it's not. It's surprising because he's this older socialist, wild hair, Brooklyn accent, you know, he's not even a registered Democrat, okay? So, you know,
he does a great Larry David impersonation.
True. And so, you know, the idea that this guy would sort of be exciting, you know, you can understand why Obama excited younger people. The idea that Bernie Sanders would excite younger people, it seems a little strange. On the other hand, if you look at the Democratic primary electorate, there is a hunger for populism, a hunger for kind of speaking truth to power. Start with Elizabeth Warren, go to Bill de Blasio. I mean, there is a part of the Democratic primary electorate that wants that kind of candidate. So in that sense, it's not surprising. And of course, the questions people have been asking about Hillary, will she be progressive enough? Will she be far left enough? How will she be able to capture that energy? Well, that's sort of what Bernie Sanders has been able to do, though post the first debate, her lead over Bernie Sanders has widened. And I believe it's because, again, people were reminded, oh, wait, she's actually smart and articulate and has something to say and has standing and is presidential. And I think they looked at Bernie Sanders and said, not so much.
Vin, anything on the Democratic side that's surprising to you?
I think Anna's got it right. I have to chuckle a little bit. When a Democrat describes Bernie Sanders, they talk about populism and speaking truth to power. When a Republican talks about Bernie Sanders, it's just moving the party to the far left. That's how we're going to describe it. I do think the party has moved to the left ideologically. I think the Republicans moved to the right ideologically starting about the time Obama was elected. And we sort of glossed over the fact that underneath the surface, there were a lot of forces moving the Democrats in the other direction. And now we're going to have in this election, and I don't think Bernie Sanders is going to be the nominee, but I think he's had an impact on the agenda in the Democratic Party. We're going to have an election between two highly polarized political parties in this country, which has not always been the case. A lot of people may not know that, thinking about politics these last few years. But, you know, there was a time when when the candidates agreed on an awful lot of things and the two parties overlapped on a lot of things. That's not going to be the case in this election.
Can I make one point, though, about the party moving to the left? The important thing about Bernie Sanders is it has forced Hillary Clinton to change her tone on Wall Street. And I think Wall Street will be a big part of the conversation in the general election in 2016.
Right.
So she has taken a series of positions around CEO pay and other reforms of Wall Street that I'm not clear she would have done in such a full-throated way if not for Bernie Sanders in the primary.
Right. I think that's right.
Clearly, Hillary Clinton is not thrilled with Bernie Sanders' record on guns, but that argument is more about policy and not as much of a food fight as we see on the Republican side. Vin, basically, the Republican argument seems to be more personal. You'll hear Trump attacking Jeb Bush on this or that. Everybody's an idiot. Everybody's a loser. How does the Republican Party unite? Because the Democratic Party seems to be at least coalescing behind the front runner, not so much on the Republican side.
You're right. The tone, particularly coming from Donald Trump, is particularly negative personally about his opponents, and it's inspired a counterreaction. But the difference between us and the Democrats, which is not good for us, is that there are big policy differences emerging within our party. The differences over immigration are real. The differences over trade are real and historic proportions. The differences on some aspects of our approach to the Middle East. Donald Trump wants to seize the oil fields of Iraq and appropriate the revenues for the United States. There are some big issues that divide Republicans, even if you get beyond name-calling and personal disdainful remarks and things like that, that we got to work out.
What about issues on the Democratic side, Anna?
I think there's a lot more consensus, certainly on the social issues, certainly on things like climate change. I think on immigration reform, I think the only area where there's a little bit of a disconnect is trade. But with Hillary Clinton coming out against TPP, I think she'll unite Democrats on trade. You know, I just think there's a lot more consensus on the Democratic side. I would just push back a little bit. A lot of the positions that Hillary Clinton takes and the party takes are pretty mainstream. And there, I think there are more mainstream Democratic positions than there are mainstream Republican positions. I'm not saying there aren't mainstream Republicans, but Kasich and Rubio and Bush, the ones who are articulating them, are not the people being heard.
Well. No, I agree with that.
What about this scenario? If Hillary Clinton is polarizing to Republicans and whomever the Republicans put up is polarizing to the Democrats, do you see an avenue or an opening for a third party or independent candidate?
I think that there's a space there that could be filled by a third party candidate. If you actually try to look at how that happens in terms of ballot access and funding a campaign and things like that, it's fairly difficult. But I think that your point, Ken, is valid. I mean, if you've got Republicans moving to the right and Democrats moving to the left, there still is a center in American politics, and there could be an avenue for somebody to come into it. You know, if you want to think in broad historic terms, we're fairly unique in this country in having had two parties dominating our political process, and both of them more or less centrist. There's a famous quote from, I think it was Gladstone when he was Prime Minister of England, who came over here for his first visit to America, went back and reported to the British Parliament, "Well, I visited the Republicans. They're like our conservatives. Then I visited the Democrats, and they're like our conservatives." And the two parties were sort of close together. The fact that that is not the case anymore is making us look a little more like multi-party democracies in terms of preferences than other countries. Now, there are, as I said, there's structural reasons why it's hard for an independent or third-party candidate to get very far. But there certainly is a, if you will, philosophical and intellectual space for that kind of a challenge.
Anna, you've heard rumors, Jim Webb, Michael Bloomberg. I mean, we also know that Ross Perot spent $60 million, which is a lot of money in 1992, and got zero electoral votes. So we always like to talk about the fantasy of a third-party or independent candidate making a difference. Many times they do not. Most times they do not.
Well, third-party candidates make a difference because sometimes they help somebody else win by taking away whomever the dissatisfied voters are. If in the case of Nader, it was people on the left who thought Gore wasn't liberal enough. In the case of, you know, Perot, certainly the second time around was taking away Republicans. They have a big impact. But, you know, it's not just the structural reasons that Vin mentioned. Constitutionally, in a winner-take-all, without proportional representation, it's very hard to have anything but a two-party system. But I would not rule out in certain states that are close. Look, the public polls right now, you can say what you will about Trump and Hillary, they're all the same. Hillary is tied against every single Republican. Mm-hmm. So the general election is really competitive, really tight. Most states, depending on who the Republican nominee is, will be as competitive as they were in earlier cycles. So a third party in Ohio, in Florida, you know, maybe Colorado or Wisconsin.
Jim Webb in Virginia, perhaps.
Could actually throw the election, you know, to somebody. But the idea that that person would emerge as a real possibly being president seems implausible to me.
I think it's implausible, too. But keep in mind, 41% of the people, according to Gallup, now identify themselves as independents. It's the highest margin over the Republicans and the Democrats that we've ever seen. Now, that's a little deceptive because they don't all agree by any means. There's left-wing independents, right-wing independents, and independents all over the place. But the point is the two parties are, relatively speaking, in less favor right now than they've been perhaps ever in our lifetimes.
I know, I mean, we have a long way to go, but first of all, give me your prediction quickly for running mate. Forget about the nominee. Who's the running mate?
I don't know if I can actually. John Kasich is a great running mate for just about any Republican, assuming that Kasich does not win the nomination himself, because Ohio is such a swing state. And John has a message and a platform that I think would be attractive to a broad range of voters. He doesn't polarize the way some of the other candidates do. So he's good. There's a lot of talk always about Susana Martinez, the governor of New Mexico, a woman, an Hispanic, and a former prosecutor. She's kind of got the same resume as Chris Christie, but we keep talking about Christie for president and not Martinez.
Is he still running?
I guess some of us keep talking about it. So those are a couple of the names that I hear. What's interesting to me to think about, I'm a Bush person, but if Trump gets nominated, that's a very interesting question. Who would he pick that would not diminish his appeal as an outsider?
Could he pick himself as running mate? Oh, no. What about on the Democratic side? I mean, if you look at the presidential candidates, they're not spring chickens. I mean, I'm not playing the ageism, you know, that game, but they're young, up-and-coming Democrats. Who are some of them, Anna?
Well, I think, you know, Castro is from Texas, who's currently the Secretary of
Housing.
I think is the name that's been bandied about. And I think the reason, I mean, he's good, but more than that, if Hillary Clinton, and I believe she'll be the nominee. So I don't know who Hillary Clinton will pick, but it'll be somebody younger, potentially somebody diverse. And you know, luckily for the Democratic Party, we have a lot of those people.
I've heard one argument, and I want to hear what Anna says about this. I've heard one argument from somebody I respect that says he thinks that Hillary Clinton will pick a woman as his running mate, as her running mate. My first reaction was, no, of course not. And then I thought, well, you know, up until fairly recently, we always had two men on the ticket. Why can't we have two women on the ticket? Furthermore, you look at what Bill Clinton did when he picked his running mate. He picked somebody that was as close to him as he possibly could. Al Gore from the neighboring state, and Al Gore at the time was considered a centrist Democrat, not more to the left like he is now. Maybe that's the logic she'll use.
I mean, everybody...
That choice conveyed a kind of youthful energy to try and reinvent the country. Yeah. And so that's why it sort of made sense. So I think it would be fabulous if she picked a woman.
You can't take any other position on this, Anna.
No, but it has to have a narrative associated with it. And what is that narrative? And again, I think with Clinton and Gore, you're exactly right. That didn't make a lot of sense, but it conveyed, I mean, just excitement and youth and energy. You know, Obama picked Biden because he wanted a gray hair because he didn't have that much experience and he wanted people to feel real. So what's the narrative?
Bush Cheney.
Right. So what? So if she picks another woman, that's fine. But there has to be a narrative about it.
This is a year to go before 2016. I mean, a lot can change. I think a lot can change next week. But what do we know now that might help us instruct us for the next 12 months?
Oh, boy. Well, we've talked about some of it. We know that the country would prefer not to have a third Obama term. And we know that the demographic and electoral college advantage goes to the Democrats. Those are things that are not likely to change, or at least not change very much in the course of the next couple of years. We also know that the course of the economy matters a great, great deal. And that's something we can't predict and, unfortunately, at least in the short run, can't probably even control. And the world is a little more important. I mean, we've seen foreign policy perk up a little bit as an issue of saliency, and there's a lot of problems around the world. The Russians are back in the Middle East, and the Russians are in Ukraine, and the Chinese are pushing out in the South China Sea, and the Middle East is in turmoil. So, you know, we can never forget the fact that the real world does affect elections. People may not go to the voting booth with a list of issues that they vote on, but what's happening around the world, particularly in terms of the economy and America's position in the world, ultimately matter a great deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with all that. And I think that if Hillary Clinton were the nominee, that would help in terms of the international environment, because she would at least have the standing and gravitas as having been Secretary of State, even if you don't necessarily agree with everything that the Obama administration did. A lot of this depends on what happens to the Republican caucus in the House. And if the Republican caucus wreaks mayhem, like doesn't raise the debt limit, shuts down the government, there could be a huge problem for the brand of the Republican Party, which might make it a wave election. So what happens with that Republican caucus has the potential to sort of, I think, destroy the Republican brand, that plus a Trump. If he were the nominee, I think there would be people worried we're going to elect a banana republic if that was the group that we elected to run our government.
I absolutely agree with that, unfortunately. And you look at when Boehner announced that he was stepping down and then McCarthy announced that he was not running again, Trump took credit for it. So there is, whether we want it or not, there's a linkage between what's going on in the Republican nominating process for president and the House of Representatives. And so I agree, as Anna pointed out, if the Republicans over the course of the next 6 months or so prove unable to run the House as a functioning institution, it's going to splash over into our presidential nominating contest, too. And there's the great risk that people, notwithstanding the fact, as I was going to say one more time, Ken, that they don't want a third Obama term, may say they don't want to become, as Anna put it, a banana republic.
So if we don't know what's going to happen, does that mean you guys will come back for another show?
Always.
We'll come back whether you want us or not.
Vin Weber is a partner at Mercury Lobbying Firm, a former member of Congress from Minnesota and a leading Republican strategist. Anna Greenberg is a senior vice president with the research firm Greenberg, Quinlan, and Rosner, and a leading Democratic pollster. Anna and Vin, it was great to have you on this special program.
Well, again, I am honored to have been invited to be on it.
I'm honored, and it was a lot of fun.
While nearly all the coverage about 2016 has been on the battle for the White House, there are also fierce campaigns emerging for both the House and Senate. Both chambers are controlled by the Republicans, and while few think the Democrats can win the number of House seats to return Nancy Pelosi to the speakership, they need a net gain of 30, the Senate is definitely up for grabs. We'll start with the House and Lisa Hagan of National Journal's Hotline. Lisa, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
Democrats argue that they always do better during presidential elections, with more women, more people of color, younger voters going to the polls. That's basically the conventional wisdom, right?
Yes. During presidential years, it's definitely a more historical trend that Democrats do better. But as you noted, it's 30 seats. That's going to be a difficult feat in an uphill battle for Democrats. Not impossible, but definitely going to be hard to, you know, maintain the seats that they have and then also gain some of the seats that they lost and then gain some new ones that they should really focus on.
Well, a fun fact is that the Democrats have not gained 30 seats when they had a Democrat in the White House since 1964 and Lyndon Johnson. So what are the odds they'll do it this time?
Yeah, it's hard to tell right now. It's still so early. We're seeing a lot of primaries get very contested. So it's hard to determine right now. But as I noted in one of my stories, you know, Democrats are going to have to go for the seats that Republicans hold that are vulnerable that went to Barack Obama in 2012. But if they really want to make a concerted effort to gain more seats and hopefully secure the majority, they're going to have to start going for districts that are more Republican-leaning that Mitt Romney won in 2012.
Well, we still have a long way to go. We don't have the presidential nominees yet, but how important is the presidential race when it comes to the battle for the House?
Well, as you noted before, Democrats just historically do better in presidential years and then in midterms.
Unless it's a Republican landslide like 1980 with Reagan. So
yeah, right? So it you know, still depends. But if it is someone like Hillary Clinton at the top of the ticket, that could be a boon for some Democrats in some districts. But it would really depend on how she's viewed at the time. You know, during the summer, her favorability, and she wasn't doing as well. And then ever since the debate and the Benghazi hearing. The first debate, yeah. And then the Benghazi hearing, you know, her favorability has been climbing. People are saying she won the debate and that she's, you know, viewed more presidentially. So it really depends on how she'll perform or who's even at the top of the ticket for either party.
We always talk about the structural reasons why Republicans are expected to hold on to the House. Why don't you give us a few reasons? I know that redistricting is one of them.
Yeah, and that's something that we're really going to have to start keeping an eye on because it's still up in the air. Circuit Judge Terry Lewis gave a ruling. He gave a recommendation. It's now up to the Florida Supreme Court.
We're talking about the Florida district.
Florida,
right?
Redistricting, yes. So it's still up in the air, but starting to see a few districts that are and a few incumbents that are going to start to be really vulnerable. And before that even happened, we were seeing a lot of people, you know, leaving their House seats to run for Senate, one of them being David Jolly. He saw that in Florida 13, his chances weren't looking so great based on the possible recommendations, and he's now running for Senate.
Based on the new potential drawing of the district, right?
Yes. So.
And there's some famous Democrat or famous Republican-turned-Independent-turned-Democrat who's running in that district.
We are seeing a Charlie Crist comeback, and that's going to be one to definitely keep an eye on.
We were talking about Florida a few minutes ago, and one of the big turnabouts in the redistricting there is Dan Webster. Now, Dan Webster was pretty recently talking about running, was a candidate for Speaker of the House, and now he may find himself without a district, or at least a favorable district, once the districts are redrawn.
Yeah, he's one of the few districts that are definitely going to be, if the Supreme Court goes with Terry Lewis's, the circuit judge's recommendations, he can find himself in a more vulnerable district as well. And he's seeing two Democratic opponents emerge, and, you know, possibly others can emerge as well.
The main issues that the presidential candidates are talking about on the Republican side, they're talking about immigration. The Democratic side, they're talking about income inequality. Do you see any themes emerging in the battle for the House?
Yeah, as you noted, immigration is a big one, and that is probably going to keep coming up, whether it's presidential or on more down-ballot races, especially because the Latino vote is going to be a very important one for people to really start focusing on, especially if Republicans want to win the presidency, but more towards down-ballot races and specifically in House. It's, you know, still a long ways away, but it'll be interesting to see if more foreign policy and national security issues pop up. I think that'll be something to keep an eye on. Last cycle seemed to be a lot of economic issues and domestic issues, and that's always something that, you know, constituents will focus on because that impacts them at home.
Again, we still have a long way to go, but Are there any incumbents who jump out at you who may be especially vulnerable, aside from Florida?
Yeah, in New Hampshire 1, Frank Ginta, he's already facing a Republican challenger, and then
he has ethics problems.
Yes, so he's facing that as well. And then he has a Republican challenger, Dan Innes, who actually outraised him in the last fundraising quarter. And then, you know, as I was talking about rematches, that's another one. Former Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter, who also held that seat and has been kind of going back and forth between her and Ginta, she's running again, and she also faces a Democratic opponent. So that'll be interesting to see how the race shakes out in both respective primaries and see, you know, if he'll be hurt with his ethics problems.
Lisa Hagan works at National Journalist Hotline, where she focuses on House races. She's on Twitter at L.A. Hagan, H-A-G-E-N-N-J. That's National Journal or New Jersey.
Or New Jersey. You can go Jersey. Either way.
That's right. Lisa, it was great having you on the program.
Thanks so much, Ken.
Our house in the middle of our street. Our house in the middle of our street.
Gets up late for work. Mother has to iron his shirt. Then she sends the kids to school. Sees them off with a small kiss. She's the one they're going to miss in lots of ways.
Now we go to the Senate, where the battle for control is fierce. Larry Sabato of the University of Virginia's Center for Politics is an elections expert known for his crystal ball reports. Larry, it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Ken. Great to be with you.
Well, the numbers certainly favor Democratic gains. There are 34 seats that are up. 24 of them are held by Republicans, and only 10 are held by Democrats. I think more important, very few, maybe two, Democratic seats are thought to be in jeopardy, while the Republicans have a lot more worries. Who are the Republicans in the biggest trouble?
The two Republicans most likely to lose are Senators Mark Kirk of Illinois. I'd put him in the number one position. And second, Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. Both of them one-term Republicans, both of them elected in the strongly Republican off-year election of 2010. Both of them in deeply blue states, especially Illinois, likely to go for the Democratic candidate for president. So they'll be swimming upstream, and coattail can do you in, and I suspect they'll be done in, with former Democratic Senator Russ Feingold running as the Democratic nominee in Wisconsin. I think he's very likely to win.
Now, there are other seats the Republicans are nervous about. Rob Portman's numbers in Ohio don't seem to be that strong. I think that's kind of a surprise, but the numbers don't show him running away with this race.
You know, this is going to be a race, Ken, where the presidential results really matter. We've gotten to the point now in our era of polarization where more than 80% of the Senate seats go in the direction of the presidential race in the state. That is, if a presidential nominee carries a state, there's about an 80% plus chance that the nominee from the president's party will also carry that state. So that's what puts Ohio in jeopardy if the Democratic nominee ends up carrying Ohio in the presidential race. I would point really to Florida as being a very vulnerable seat because Marco Rubio, the incumbent, is moving on. As we know, he's disgusted with the Senate and not voting very much and getting a lot of criticism. But that's an open seat in a state that has been dividing fairly evenly in presidential contests of late.
Well, of course, maybe that's why so many Republicans' favorite ticket is a Marco Rubio, John Kasich ticket, because you have Florida and Ohio represented on the ticket.
That's the ticket I hear more than any other. Sometimes it's Kasich-Rubio, and sometimes it's Rubio-Kasich. But, of course, that's the leadership speaking. They actually think about the Electoral College. I don't think much of the GOP base studies the Electoral College map anymore.
One of the most fascinating races also is coming in New Hampshire, where you have the governor of New Hampshire, Maggie Hassan, challenging the Republican incumbent Kelly Ayotte.
You give a tiny edge to Ayotte because she's the incumbent, and she's been a moderate conservative, more emphasis on conservative than moderate, but it can fit New Hampshire. But, of course, Hassan is a very strong candidate. She has won repeatedly and is well-liked in New Hampshire, and again, I would guess that this would go the way of the presidential election unless it's a 50-50 split. Then I would give a tiny edge to Aon. But that's one worth watching, and the presidential race will have its influence.
You could also point to what happened in New Hampshire in 2014, a big Republican year everywhere else, but Hassan won re-election and Gene Shaheen won re-election, the other senator.
Yes, New Hampshire has been moving along the political spectrum toward the Democratic side. And, of course, when you talk to people in New Hampshire, old-timers, they say it's those damn Bay Staters, the people moving in from Massachusetts. But I think it's more than that.
Yeah, I think the Loeb family is still talking about that, aren't they?
Exactly.
One more Republican I want to talk about, because I don't know if he's more vulnerable in a primary or the general election, is John McCain in Arizona.
McCain would still be the favorite, but you and I have been around a long time. We remember that shocking Goldwater race, re-election race in 1980, when, of course, Ronald Reagan was sweeping into the White House and was carrying in all those new Republican senators with him, the Republicans taking over the Senate in 1980. And there is Mr. Republican Barry Goldwater, in whose campaign Ronald Reagan really got his political start, nearly losing. He ended up getting re-elected by a tiny margin, a little less than 51% of the vote, because he was up in age, and he had been in for so long, and the voters were sending him a message. Gee, who does that sound like? John McCain. So I still think he's the favorite, but we're watching that race very carefully with a potentially strong Democratic candidate, Congresswoman Kirkpatrick, and there is a Republican Tea Party challenger. She doesn't look to be all that strong, but again, there's going to be a protest vote.
If you look at the list, it seems like, I mean, of the 10 Democratic seats that are at stake, only two seem worth watching. The one in Nevada, where Harry Reid is retiring, and in Colorado, where the Republicans think they have a shot at Michael Bennett. How do you see those two races?
I see Bennett as being in good shape unless the Republicans somehow score a landslide in the presidential race in Colorado. Just as in North Carolina with the Democrats, in Colorado, the Republicans have been unable to find any strong candidate to run against Bennett. And again, they've been through at least a half a dozen major candidates, all of whom said no because they see the race as being very difficult. So I bet on Bennett. Nevada is the one I'll be watching. Senator Reid, of course, always had his problems, but he won handily, certainly 6 years ago, in the face of that Republican near landslide for the Senate. But this time around, the Republicans have managed to pick a moderate conservative incumbent congressman, Representative Joe Hecht. He has good relations with the Hispanic community in Nevada. The Democrats, however, are very likely to nominate a woman, an Hispanic, a Latina, to be their nominee, who will be, I think, quite strong in that election. But that's going to be determined by the presidential race. If one candidate for president ends up winning by a few percentage points in Nevada, I think the Senate seat comes as a bonus.
And you know that Harry Reid will do everything he can to keep his seat Democratic.
That's absolutely correct. He will not want to leave the Senate with his seat being filled by a Republican. Now, of course, that doesn't mean he'll get his wish, but he's pretty determined.
Larry Sabato is a widely quoted elections expert at the University of Virginia and is known for his crystal ball reports. Larry, thanks so much for being on the program.
Enjoyed being with you, Ken.
I wonder what tomorrow has in mind for me. Or am I even in its mind at all? Perhaps I'll get a chance to look ahead and see. Soon as I find myself a crystal ball. Soon as I find myself a crystal ball.
They started in 1972, but since 1976, the Iowa caucuses have unofficially kicked off the presidential election cycle. Unlike a primary, the caucuses are hours-long events where citizens will meet in a school or a church, or in someone's living room, they'll talk about issues and then express their presidential preferences. They helped launch a former governor of Georgia from Jimmy Hu to Jimmy Carter in 1976, as well as a new senator from Illinois with a strange name in 2008. Iowa isn't always a kingmaker, but it is always influential. And nobody knows the history of the Iowa caucuses better than David Yepsen, currently the director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute in Carbondale, Illinois, but for 34 years a reporter for the Des Moines Register, who covered his share of Iowa caucuses. In fact, his phone would only ring in the months leading up to the caucuses, then it would go silent for the next 4 years. David, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Good to be with you, Ken.
David, by most accounts, right now we have competitive contests in Iowa coming up on February 1st. We'll have plenty of time to talk about what's happening in 2016, but I want to spend this conversation talking about the history and the importance of the Iowa caucuses. What started it all?
The 1968 Chicago Democratic Convention. In 1968, as you recall, the Democrats tore themselves apart on the streets of Chicago. And they came out of that convention and decided, we got to open up our party. We've got to be more inclusive. We've got to reach out to people. And so they started an elaborate process of rewriting the rules of their nomination process to give activists, local activists, more influence.
And to make it more democratic, right?
Yeah.
Small D Democratic.
Small D Democratic. George McGovern and his young campaign manager, a guy named Gary Hart, looked at Iowa, at the Iowa process, and said, gee, there are a lot of anti-war activists out there. Why don't we go do some campaigning in Iowa and try to make a showing in the 1972 caucuses, and that might help us in New Hampshire. So they did, and McGovern, it was a stormy night. Muskie was the heavy favorite. Muskie actually won the 72 caucuses, but McGovern had one of those, what is now famously known as the unexpectedly strong showing. And then McGovern, when he went on and captured the nomination, the nation's political community looked at that and said, you know, Iowa was telling us something.
So I know that some newspapers covered it and McGovern got a little bump out of Iowa, but it really didn't get the kind of national attention that certainly New Hampshire got. When do we first really start paying attention to the Iowa caucuses?
Well, McGovern's showing in Iowa wasn't lost on Jimmy Carter in Georgia in 1974 and Hamilton Jordan and his campaign manager. And they looked at that and said, you know, that's where this thing is really starting. So the answer to the question is it started big time in the 76 cycle because Carter and other Democratic presidential candidates started to go to Iowa in 1975 and organize and start to work. And of course, when Carter finished first among the candidates on caucus night, undecided and uncommitted were actually the winners. But it elevated him in the nomination contest. I mean, it helped him raise money. It helped him get media attention and really launched him into New Hampshire in a big way. And that really cemented him.
Here's Carter basically talking about those early campaign maneuvers in 1976.
We began to go from one living room to another, one labor hall to another, up and down the streets, factory shift lines, barbershops, beauty parlors, restaurants, shaking hands, talking to people, and listening.
So, I mean, that's basically, I mean, Jimmy Carter went from Jimmy Who to Jimmy Carter, thanks to Iowa. But we also know that the record on Iowa caucus winners, they don't always go on to win the nomination. Talk a little bit about 1988 and what happened there.
Well, in 1988, Bob Dole was running, and he captured the vote in the Iowa caucuses. The main thing that happened in 88 was the strong showing by religious conservatives. Pat Robertson came in second, beat Vice President Bush, and that really marked the arrival of religious conservatives in national Republican politics.
You also had the two candidates who finished third in the respective Republican and Democratic caucuses, Bush and Michael Dukakis, yet they went on to win the nomination.
Right, and that's really when the phrase three tickets out of Iowa became popular, you know, first class coach and standby. That the function of Iowa sometimes would be, like Carter, to elevate a candidate to the nomination, or it could also be winnow the field. Howard Baker in 1980, after the Republican caucuses, he said, Iowa winnows the field and I've been winnowed in. And so in 88, in both of those cases, you had the rest of the field sort of winnowed out. But the Dukakis and Bush got winnowed in. They made it across the line and went on into New Hampshire.
It seems like if you look at the history of the Republican winners, at least, it seems like more people, more candidates who win in Iowa don't necessarily go on to win the nomination.
I think that's probably right. But I do think in all cases, it does winnow the field. It already eliminates some candidates who are not doing so well. And I mean, I think you've seen that here in the 2016 cycle with Governor Scott Walker.
Yeah, you talked about in 1988, the rise of Pat Robertson and the rise of evangelical voters. And we also know that perhaps because of that rise, Rick Santorum won the Republican caucuses last time out. Mike Huckabee won it before that. What is the influence of evangelical Christian voters in the Iowa Republican caucuses?
Oh, I think the influence is big. They are represent a growing share of the electorate in the state party, particularly in recent years. You look at the participants, the demographics of who shows up, a lot more evangelicals are participating and religious conservatives and hardcore conservatives and participated even, say, in the mid-90s.
And then you also have, on the other side, on the Democrats, there are those who are perhaps more to the left than the rest of the party nationwide, or at least more on economic and foreign policy issues.
That's correct. I mean, one of the criticisms made of the process is that it can pull nominees either too far to the right in the Republican Party or too far to the left in the Democratic Party and make them unelectable in November. I mean, that was really pronounced in 1984. Remember that there was the nuclear freeze movement going on then, and a lot of peace activists were arguing that Democratic candidates ought to support that. And it caused this questions about the role of these activists in pulling nominees too far in one direction or the other. That's one of the criticisms made of the caucus process. The flip side of that, though, is the people who show up at a caucus look an awful lot like the people you see on the floor of the national conventions. I mean, you've got the different constituencies. In the Republican side, it's the Second Amendment conservatives and the Tea Partiers and the pro-lifers. And on the Democratic side, it's labor, it's teachers, it's civil rights activists, peace people. And those are the kinds of people that show up at caucuses. Those are the kind of people that get elected delegates to the national convention.
When we look back at what happened in 2008, when, you know, there was John Edwards running, there was Hillary Clinton running, but there was also this guy named Barack Obama who went on to win the caucuses. That, I think, Iowa showed that Barack Obama was for real.
Well, it was interesting. The criticism that's always made of Iowa is it's an atypical place because it's 96% white. That was a criticism for the entire history. It still is. But in Obama's case, he went in front of that electorate, and he won. And that was very important, particularly to African-American voters around the country who were, at the time, leaning toward Hillary Clinton. And in South Carolina, the numbers changed overnight, and Obama really started to perform well, particularly among his fellow African-Americans. They saw he could win white votes.
Here's Obama on caucus night in 2008.
They said this day would never come. They said our sights were set too high. They said this country was too divided, too disillusioned to ever come together around a common purpose. But on this January night, at this defining moment in history, you have done what the cynics said we couldn't do.
That was pretty dramatic stuff. It led to the legitimacy of Barack Obama, but also, I guess, questions about Hillary Clinton.
Indeed. She finished third, and that was a big embarrassment for her and really told us that we were in for a long nomination fight.
Do you have a favorite moment? I mean, you cover the caucuses for so many years. Do you have a favorite caucus moment, either not a big headline, but just something you really, really personally enjoyed?
Well, you started with the 76 campaign. I was a young reporter. And would always get assigned to unknown candidates and went to a Jimmy Carter press conference on a Sunday afternoon, which was an odd time, but I remember that. And I was the only reporter that showed up. So I had a nice visit with Governor Carter, and he was munching on grapes during the interview. I remember that. Another favorite story of mine comes from that 88 campaign. It was Senator Joe Biden was campaigning in a town called Carroll, Iowa. It was about 10,000 people. And he and an aide and I were traveling. This was back when reporters could hop in the back seat with a candidate. Went to check in at a hotel about midnight. And everybody was hungry. And Biden said to the clerk, you know, is there someplace we can get something to eat? And the kid said, well, there's a Godfather's Pizza down the street. They'll still be there open late. And so one of the aides said, well, let's get a cab. Well, you don't have cabs in small Iowa towns at midnight. And so the kid reached in his pocket and handed him his car keys and said, here, take my car. but I got to have you back here at 12:30 because I've got a date. So off we go. Biden behind the wheel. This car is kind of a jacked up and a little dice in the front, you know, and off we go roaring into the deserted streets of Carroll, Ohio. We go to the pizza place. We have our pizza. Biden's watching his wrist. He says, we got to get back for this kid. He orders a pizza. We take it into the hotel. The kid is just dumbfounded. You know, he says, well, thank you for the pizza. And I think that was probably one of my favorite stories because, you don't see that anymore. But at midnight in Carroll, Iowa, here's a United States senator running for the presidency, ordering pizza and giving it to some kid, thanking him for letting him use his car.
You could say it was a slice of political history.
Yeah, literally.
You know, they got rid of the Iowa straw poll this year. Do you envision a time when Iowa loses its first in the nation status? They always threaten that every 4 years. I know that.
Yeah, it's always talked about. And the Iowans respond. They always try to listen to the criticism. You know, they had problems 4 years ago with the count. Both parties are working with Microsoft this year to try to deliver a more precise, accurate count. But yeah, there's nothing that guarantees Iowa or New Hampshire or South Carolina or Nevada are going to remain first. The problem is nobody can agree on an alternative. Everybody's got their own idea. You know, if you like regional primaries and money in politics, they'll go hand in glove. And so there's a problem with every alternative. If you move the start of the process to any other state, you know, okay, and wherever you start the selection of an American president, that's a big deal news story. And it's going to have a disproportionate influence. So I think it's always possible the two parties will come together and say, no, we're going to do this differently. But inertia, the inability to agree on a change, will tend to keep them first. And remember, there's usually somebody in the White House who has got a base of operations in Iowa, who either won Iowa or who did well there. And, you know, they're not about to change the rules of a game they just won. Obama loves Iowa. Jimmy Carter, interestingly enough, maintained his fences in Iowa. In 1980, when Ted Kennedy was challenging him in Iowa, Carter had a firewall there. So incumbent presidents who win Iowa and who have organizations there and who set the rules for their party, they tend to like to keep Iowa around. And New Hampshire, they're good firewalls against somebody coming up against them.
David Yepsen is the director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute in Carbondale, Illinois. For 34 years, he was a reporter for the Des Moines Register. David, thanks for this visit down memory lane.
Thanks for having me.
Running. Come on, y'all. Let's get
We haven't even reached 2016, and yet this campaign cycle has already seen so many unconventional candidates and mind-blowing surprises. Even seasoned political junkies have no clue as to how next year's general election will turn out. With so many questions swirling around this election, we invited our listeners to ask us what they want to know about the politics of 2016. And to help me answer those questions, we brought Greg Giroux of Bloomberg News back to the program. He's one of those political junkies who's filled with useless campaign knowledge, the kind of guy we'd love to have. Greg, are you ready for this challenge?
I'm ready for the physical challenge, as I used to say on that old show, Double Dare.
Well, this is an old show as well. Okay, here's an email from Bob Brister of Salt Lake City, Utah. He wants to know about the history of changes in presidential primary rules and the effect of the changes. And I think, Greg, I mean, when you think of changing primary rules, you have to go back to 68 and the convention in Chicago. That's what basically started all the changes on the Democratic side, certainly.
Yeah, it was at that convention, the very raucous Chicago convention, that prompted the Democrats to open up their rules. They established a commission called the McGovern-Fraser Commission that...
George McGovern and Joe Frazier, the heavyweight champion, right? No, it was Don Frazier.
What a pairing that would have been. What a ticket that would have been in 1972. So the McGovern-Fraser Commission set up, you know, it basically democratized the process by taking, you know, a lot of the power for selecting the delegates from the so-called party bosses and those.
Let me just interrupt because, I mean, if you think of 1968, Hubert Humphrey won the Democratic nomination not having won a single primary, let alone entered a single primary. And so obviously there was not small-d Democratic rules in 68. Certainly.
That's right. And Bobby Kennedy, before he was assassinated, entered the race in mid-March of that year. In those days, and you bring up a point about how the convention and primary process has changed in those days. Until the late 60s, early 70s, most of the delegates were determined through caucuses and conventions, controlled by the so-called party bosses. And then after the 68 convention, both parties started to gravitate more toward selecting delegates in primary elections, open up the process more. But that's had the effect of not only front-loading the process, where candidates are beginning their campaigns much earlier in the process to win those primaries, because when those elections are opened up and more voters are participating with the advent of television and television advertising, it costs a lot of money to run races in all these primaries. And we're seeing candidates enter the race much earlier than they did decades ago.
And of course, by doing that also, and with having the front-loading of primaries, the campaigns are over earlier than ever. No longer are they being fought out at the conventions, except for maybe Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama that went on until June of 08. For the most part, these battles for the nomination are over in March, April, the latest.
That's right. And the Clinton-Obama race went to early June, as you mentioned, was pretty rare. I'm reminded of when Bill Clinton announced his candidacy for president in 1991. It was on October the 3rd, which is...
You remember that. Why do you remember that?
I remember it because, I'm a political junkie, listens to your show, so I'm sure you brought it up once or twice, but it just, that date just reminds me of just how much the presidential campaign process had changed so much over the last 30 or 40 years. When John F. Kennedy announced for president, it was, I believe, the 2nd of January, the 3rd of January of 1960.
Of the year of the election,
the
right.
year of the election.
Yeah, right.
And Bill Clinton entered the race in early October of 1991. And as we tape in late October, that's really almost an equivalent point of the 2016 campaign. When Vice President Biden announced in late October that he would not enter the race, he said the window is closed. You know, a generation ago, that window still would have been... You know, pretty ajar, I would say.
And you think of people like Phil Crane of Illinois and Mo Udall of Arizona. They, I think, announced their candidacy 2 years in advance, right?
That's right. And Jimmy Carter Jimmy Carter began campaigning probably in late 1974, early 1975, about 2 years before he was elected.
Here's a question from Stephen Brown of Tucson, Arizona. He wants to know why we don't combine Veterans Day and Election Day into one holiday. And he says, where we honor veterans by exercising our right to vote, by conducting elections that they sacrificed so much to ensure would happen. I mean, I think that's an honorable purpose, but also it could probably increase turnout at the same time, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the many proposals that's been bandied around over the years, you know, to kind of honor our biennial and quadrennial traditions of voting for Congress and for president and to encourage more voting. But the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November has been on the books for a very long time. You know, the Tuesday vote that we have in early November has been around since the early days of the Republic, when we were an agrarian society and you needed time to, you couldn't go down the, walk down the street or drive down the street to get to your polling station. You had to go a long way, and we have Tuesday elections, and it's just been on the books for a very long time. And it's very hard to change laws that deal with political process, because there's really not a galvanizing public influence behind changes like that.
Sean in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, points to all the Republicans seeking the presidency. He wants to know if there have ever been so many candidates from one party to choose from. My understanding is that this is the largest presidential field in any party's history, but I should note that 14 Democrats ran in 1976, and it just so happens I have the list in front of me. Birch Bayh, Lloyd Benson, Jerry Brown, Robert Byrd, Jimmy Carter, Frank Church, Fred Harris, Henry Jackson, Henry Scoop Jackson, Ellen McCormick, Terry Sanford, Milton Schapp, Sergeant Shriver, Mo Udall, and George Wallace. So that's 14 Democrats right there. So we've had big presidential fields in the past, just not this big.
Yeah, that's right. I think you probably have to go back a century or more to find a Republican field that's comparably as big. But, you know, one kind of asterisk you have to put on this is, you know, what is a, quote, candidate? You know, anyone can file papers with the Federal Election Commission and run for president, but, you know, some candidates are included in polls and others are not. You know, there's a former IRS commissioner, Mark Everson, running for the Republican nomination, who's actually put in a decent amount of his own money, a couple hundred thousand dollars, I think. But he's not included in any of the polls, so he's not really included as a candidate. And in candidate fields of 1976, even further back, you had candidates running as so-called, you know, favorite son candidates. Who weren't, maybe they were campaigning, maybe they were not, but they weren't running full-fledged operations like you see in modern campaigning.
That leads to another question from Andrew Conkling of Kalamazoo, Michigan. He wants to know why there's been such silence about Lawrence Lessig's bid for the Democratic nomination and why he's been shut out of the debates.
Yeah, that's a good question. I was a little bit surprised he wasn't included in the last Democratic debate, the one where you had Lincoln Chafee on the stage.
I mean, are his numbers any worse than Lincoln Chafee's were, right?
Yeah, probably polling below 1% like Chafee did and like Jim Webb did. Jim Webb also participated in that debate.
He needed more time, though.
And Lessig raised more than $1 million from donors. It didn't include any personal money. So he's lagging in the polls. He has a kind of an unorthodox campaign platform. He initially said that he was going to resign the presidency if elected after he solved the campaign finance corruption problem that is the linchpin of his campaign. He's backed away from that right now. But yeah, I was a little bit surprised he wasn't included in the debate, considering there was plenty of room on that Democratic dais compared to the Republican show.
I was just looking at some of the questions that came in, and good luck with this one, Greg.
Okay.
Kerry Conger of Prattville, Alabama, has two questions. One, why do we have staggered primaries? Is it fair to allow voters in early primaries to whittle down the candidates before the rest of us get to vote? And the second question is, why is the Electoral College still in existence? Lots of luck with that, Greg.
All right, Electoral College, here we go. But first, let me address the staggered primaries. We've had staggered primaries in the modern primary nomination system. You know, the idea is to just create an orderly process where states have their turn in the spotlight. You don't have to, and candidates don't have to run these huge media-intensive campaigns across big swaths of the country. You know, another reason for the staggered primaries is you can actually campaign in individual states and get to know voters, go in their living rooms, talk to them in their clubs and that sort of thing.
But I think part of the question is, like, if you're in New Jersey or Indiana or Nebraska, historically have late on the calendar primaries, their votes are basically meaningless because so often the nominations are decided certainly before then.
That's true. And the whittling process that occurs in a modern presidential primary process is very powerful. You know, and candidates are campaigning in a 24/7 media cycle now. And after the early states vote, like Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, candidates that exceed expectations or win, just there's so much money and attention that accrue to them at the expense of candidates who perform below expectations that the field tends to winnow very quickly. And by the time you get to, states that are later in the process, yeah, their votes don't matter that much because the whittling process, the winnowing process of the field is very powerful.
Electoral College?
On the Electoral College, well, first of all, it's been on the books since the very beginning, and we don't amend our Constitution all that frequently, only 27 times in about 230 years. It's a political process issue, and that's very hard to get the public to rally around changing an issue of political process. Another reason it's stuck around is it benefits smaller states, and in the political architecture of the Senate, every state has two senators. Now, the 17 least populous states have 34 senators total, enough to block a constitutional amendment from passing the Senate. But they only have 23 million people, which is fewer than you see in Texas or in California.
I was going to say, if you got rid of the Electoral College and just went for popular vote, no longer would candidates care about states like New Hampshire, Nevada, Iowa, which are considered very, very close and competitive. If they just went for a popular vote, you'd campaign in New York, California, Texas, and the big states, right?
That's right. You'd want to ramp up your vote totals in the big metropolitan areas. You'd see campaigning in places you don't see it now. I think you probably would see as much campaigning in states like Ohio and Florida, which are the rare big states to be presidential bellwethers now. But yeah, you would see it changes in strategy by the candidates if you went to a popular vote system.
We turn to the phones for another question.
Hey, Ken, it's Brooks from Menlo Park in California. My question is kind of a fool's errand. I'd like to get the educated guesses of your panel on who they think both the Republican and Democratic tickets will be next year, and that includes deep picks. My guess at this point is Rubio and Kasich versus Clinton and Vilsack. I'd be interested to hear what your panel thinks. Bye for now.
Well, let me turn to my panel, Greg. I mean, lots of luck with picking the Republican nominee for president, let alone running mate. But on the Democratic side, I think there's certainly a conventional wisdom on who the leading Democrat is, and perhaps about a running mate as well.
Yeah, I think you have to rate Hillary Clinton as a strong favorite to win the Democratic nomination, despite some stumbles early and some strong showings by her leading opponent, Bernie Sanders, in some early state polls. But Clearly, she has the, you know, a very strong edge for the nomination there. As for her vice presidential nominee or whoever wins the Republican nomination, I really have no idea. I picked a Cubs Blue Jays World Series, so I think my opinion probably matters is almost meaningless. So there are just so many different possibilities out there. One thing I will say is I wouldn't overthink the politics of picking vice presidential candidates. I don't think vice presidential candidates can deliver states like LBJ could in 1960.
That's
with
the only
Texas.
Example I can think of, too.
That's the only example we could really think of. And what we've seen.
Although Dick Cheney carried Wyoming, so there was that.
That's right. He got George W. Bush to 69% in Wyoming instead of 66. So, right. And then, you know, Barack Obama even brought Joe Biden in to carry Delaware's crucial three right. electoral votes. So I think they'll pick nominees where they obviously have a personal and professional rapport, but also where maybe their backgrounds kind of dovetail with each other. Obama picked Biden in large part because of his experience as an old hand in the Senate with foreign policy chops.
And same with Bush picking Cheney, who had international experience that Bush did not have.
That's right. Yeah. So I think the presidential nominees, whoever they'll be, will pick vice presidential nominees whose maybe background and political experience is a little bit different than their own.
Let me add one more voicemail question for this week.
Ken, this is Ben Mann of Ashburn, Virginia. And my question is, what are the chances of a brokered convention in the 2016 Republican race? If that happens, are there any rules or all bets off? Thanks.
I mean, that is the fantasy of every political junkie, a brokered convention. We talk about it every cycle. And when you had, you know, the 700 candidates on the Republican side earlier this year, we said, wow, this is going to be a brokered convention. We always talk about it. It never happens.
Never happens. The last presidential convention that went to more than one ballot.
Go ahead.
I believe was in 1952.
That is correct.
With Adlai Stevenson.
On the third ballot.
And one of my favorite movies about politics, The Best Man, starred Henry Fonda playing a Adlai Stevenson-like character who went to a brokered convention or a deadlock convention. I won't reveal how it ends. Of course, it's a good movie. But there is a very slim chance of that happening. But yeah, it never does happen. Not in this era of 24/7 coverage, and when conventions are now pro forma affairs and meticulously stage managed without a hint of dissension, you just don't see that.
I think there was some surprise or some uncertainty for the Democrats in 1980 and with Kennedy and Carter, perhaps some uncertainty with the Republicans in 1976 with Ford and Reagan, but not really. And I can't imagine it for 2016.
Yeah, I can't imagine either, just because the winnowing process is very, very strong. And by the time we get to the convention in the late summer, I think you'll have a consensus candidate for the Republicans. They just they're not going to allow – I don't think that the party officials are going to allow a deadlock convention to happen just because it would just convey the wrong impression, convey disunity, and they don't want that at all for a convention. They don't want to – at a time when you have to put your best face on the party, they're going to want to have a consensus candidate.
Thanks to Greg Giroux of Bloomberg News, thank you, Greg, for helping us with all these questions, and thanks to all our listeners. 100 episodes could never have been possible without you. We are most appreciative. Greg, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Great to be here. We can celebrate you. This is your celebration.
That's it for this week's special program. Political Junkies made possible with support from WAMU here in Washington and is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. For political columns, trivia questions, scuttlebutton puzzles, and bad jokes, and to subscribe to our podcast, check out our website at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or shoot us a message on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Our show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer, and Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Thanks for listening. See you next week. It's a celebration.